Shalom and welcome to Nourish Your Biblical Roots Conversations with Yael. I'm your host, Yael Eckstein, President and CEO of the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews. On my weekly podcast, I invite thought leaders, authors, pastors, and other religious leaders, politicians, and influencers to share their views on Jewish-Christian relations, Israel, and other key issues that are of importance to people of faith today. Today, I am so pleased to welcome to the podcast Rabbi Daniel Korobkin. Rabbi Korobkin has served congregations around the United States and currently serves as senior rabbi for Beit Avraham Yosef in Toronto. As the child of a Holocaust survivor, he brings a deep understanding of not only this dark chapter in history of the Jewish people, but an understanding of what so many of those who the fellowship helps have experienced and how we can continue to help them. With a Master's of Science in Physics from Johns Hopkins and a Master of Arts in Medieval Jewish and Islamic Thought from UCLA, Rabbi Korobkin brings knowledge and curiosity to his ministry and those he ministers to. And Rabbi Korobkin is not just a knowledgeable rabbi and teacher, but he is a truly caring person, out to do God's work of tikkun olam, of fixing the world and bringing hope and healing to every single person he encounters. I've seen it firsthand. He has served on the board of IFCJ Canada since 2021, so I am privileged to call him a colleague as well as a friend and mentor. Rabbi, welcome to my podcast.
Thank you, Yael. I'm really, really honored to be able to have some time with you, together with your friends, with our friends. I so admire the work that you're doing and that the fellowship is doing for Israel and for Jews worldwide. It's the work that the IFCJ is doing is so inspiring, and I'm just so honored to be a very, very small part of it.
Well, hearing of what you're doing and what you have done for your entire career and your entire life of bridging people in unity, everywhere you go, what you foster is a respect for one another, a deep understanding. You are one of the most humble people I have ever met, and it's such an honor a natural fit that you would be part of this fellowship family. But it wasn't always that way. The truth is, I think you're the first rabbi that we've ever had on our board. And so that's why I just call you rabbi, because you're my rabbi. You're our board's rabbi. You put up the mezuzah and we all look to you for those spiritual teachings and thoughts and wisdom that you give out so generously. When was the first time that you heard about the fellowship's work, and what led you to want to get involved?
I had heard of the fellowship for years already when your father of blessed memory, Rabbi Yechiel Eckstein, was running the organization, but it was sort of on the periphery of the Jewish consciousness because your father was a true visionary and he understood that the Jewish community was being attended to, but it was the Christian community so many people within the Christian community who wanted to be part of the blessing of the Jewish people. And your father opened that door, and it was just a matter of curiosity for so many of us, especially when we saw the success that your father experienced in just creating this bridge that had never existed before in any real way. And so a few years ago, like in 2021, I guess, someone who's a mutual friend got in touch with me and said that they're trying to, grow the Canadian board and the Canadian presence of the fellowship, and asked if I would be interested in participating. I was a little bit cautious because I didn't know what it entailed, but it's just been such a blessing since then.
Wow. So you've been part of the fellowship for just a few years, but you've seen this huge kind of fundamental change of post and pre October 7th, where the needs and the work of the fellowship has changed so much, both as far as what we do on the ground and also the anti-Semitism that has been rising across the world, including in Canada. I'm wondering, as a rabbi of a congregation in Toronto, do you feel the rise of anti-Semitism? And have you felt kind of that hug of the Christian community that we always talk about? Do you feel like it's changed since October 7th?
We definitely feel the anti-Semitism rising throughout Canada. It's throughout North America and really throughout the world. On March 7th of this year, there was a huge demonstration that showed up right in front of our congregation. And it was under the pretense that we were hosting a real estate presentation just to the Jewish community, because so many people, especially since October 7th, have been thinking about what's called Aliyah, about immigrating to Israel, or just purchasing some property in Israel just to be able to know that there's a sanctuary. You know, Robert Frost once said that the definition of the word home is the place where when you go there, they have to let you in. And the Jewish people have a history of not having a home for literally thousands of years. So the land of Israel, the state of Israel, is really our home in that truest sense of the word. And as anti-Semitism has been growing, there's been a greater sense of anxiety within Jewish communities worldwide. So we had the audacity, the chutzpah, to host a real estate show, which we've done for years on a yearly basis and sometimes more than once a year, to let people know what offerings are available in different Jewish communities throughout the country. Well, this was used as a pretense by the pro-Palestinian segment of the community, which is quite sizable in the greater Toronto area, to create this raucous, aggressive, in-your-face, offensive kind of demonstration. We were very, very disappointed that the police didn't disband it. They felt that because of free speech and people's rights, that they had to allow it. But this is the first time that we've really experienced, at the very doorstep of our synagogue, people yelling at us, calling us baby killers, guilty of genocide, all of these horrible terms that are part of the propaganda of the anti-Israel lobby today. And so it really shook us to the core. I mean, they had to close the street. They had to cancel the schools that are surrounding our synagogue. We host a girls' school in our building. Everything, all the children were sent home, and it created a lot of fear in the community. But we stood up, we said enough is enough, and we're not gonna take it sitting down. So we had our own counter demonstration, and we made sure that our voice was at least as loud as theirs.
It sounds like it's actually a reminder of why you need Israel, why you need that home, as Robert Frost so clearly said, a place that no matter what, they'll let you in. And if you feel like you're not protected and safe in your synagogue in Toronto, where are Jews safe anymore? It actually reminds me of some Aliyah flights that I've been welcoming lately, mostly from France, but also from Ukraine, and hearing this really global realization of Jews around the world that there's only one place that we're safe, that's in Israel, which many people might not understand what that means. I mean, it's incredible that since October 7th, there has hardly been one day that the fellowship hasn't continued to bring Jewish people home to Israel and Aliyah, deciding to move from South America or Ukraine or South or anywhere, even as places across Africa, across the Middle East and France. Every single day, there's still Jewish people coming home. And you said something fascinating before this podcast, how you think people who are scared to come to Israel since October 7th have developed this fear because they haven't been in Israel since. But you've been to Israel many times since October 7th. Can you explain to me the feelings that you have when you're here during wartime, of the complexity, really? If on one hand, it continues to feel like home, and on the other hand, we're seeing a changed country.
Yes, absolutely. Let me just go back one second to something that you had asked me I didn't really answer, which is the outpouring of the Christian community that we've seen worldwide since October 7th. It is really, truly remarkable. Now, there are many congregations within the Christian world that are either taking a neutral stance or a wait and see stance, but there are so many congregations and so many individual Christians whose hearts are broken over what has happened in Israel since October 7th. And they have only become stronger in their commitment to Israel because they've seen so many outlets come out against the state and against the Jewish people. There's just one story that I mentioned on a recent board meeting that we had. A gentleman, a farmer just north of Saskatoon in Saskatchewan, really the heartland of farming in Canada, who called a rabbi out of the blue after he had made a donation to the fellowship. A 70-year-old farmer, he said, "My knees are shot. I'm not really able to come to Israel to support the people, but I'm just giving whatever I can, whatever from my meager earnings from my farming, because my heart is broken for the Jewish people and I want to help in any way that I can. And I heard the recording of this voice message. The man was literally in tears because he feels that, he said, I know it's not enough, but I just want to do whatever I can. And it shook so many of us so deeply. It really was so moving to see this kind of love and care. And you know, the Jewish people have to be convinced sometimes that people really do love us, because we're not used to it. And we're not always that good in accepting that care and that love. And it's, I think, one of the things that the fellowship has taught people, has taught many of the Jews worldwide, is that it's okay to be loved. And it's sometimes good to feel that embrace, even when you're not used to it, you know. But, you know, so just getting back to what you had asked me about, you know, the trips to Israel and what Israel's like now since October 7th. I've been to Israel 3 times since October 7th. The first time was in November, when it was too soon for just civilians, I guess, to tourists to come to Israel, because the war had just begun. And so there was a delegation of rabbis that I went with. The second time we went was in late December, early January, and that was with members of my congregation and some others from another congregation. And then we really were able to feel what was going on together with members of the Jewish community. The third time I went to Israel was together with you, Yael. You had led this delegation together with the board of the IFCJ. And I was one of the few Jews who was with the majority of Christians who were able to see what the devastation that had taken place since October 7th, and to see it through a Christian's eyes, I think in many ways was perhaps the most profound visit of the three. But it definitely was a very, very different experience. But to answer your question as far as what Israel is like now, when you go to Israel and you want to see what happened, you see devastation, because you go to those places just outside of the Gaza Strip, those small Jewish communities who had such hope that there could be peace with their Arab neighbors in Gaza. And you see how some of those communities were absolutely devastated, decimated, especially those communities who had such confidence in peaceful relations that they had dispensed with their armories. They didn't even have ammunition and weapons to defend themselves. Those were the hardest hit. But when you go to the rest of the country, if you're going to Jerusalem, to Tel Aviv, to Haifa, to Eilat, life goes on as normal there. It's a thriving country. The Jewish people are perhaps the most resilient people who have ever walked this earth. The ability of the average Israeli to be under such stress, to know that there is either a direct family member or a family member of a neighbor or a cousin. And there's not a single family that in Israel that has not been affected. And yet we soldier on, we move forward, because we know that there is no other option. We know that we are on the front lines, whether literally or figuratively. There is no way that the Jewish people can survive unless we all pull together, pull ourselves together, and really soldier forward.
It's incredible. You so articulate what many of us are feeling and experiencing, that contrast between the huge destruction and the inspiration, between being a country that's in war for our survival, that every single one of us has someone we love who's on the front lines right now. Every single one of us has a personal story of how we're affected by this war. And also to be in the top 5 happiest countries around the world at the same time is this resilience that stands out. I just heard actually Jordan Peterson talking about how when he reads the Hebrew Bible and he reads even our prophets, the Nevi'im, what stands out to him is even back then, the Israelites were never never were victims. They sinned, they complained, the prophets chastised them, and then they would turn around and move on and do better. That to see in the Zman Emet, as we say, in the moment of truth, with the TikTok generation and kids here being raised in the same Western society that they are in Europe and America, how they're able to build that resilience and love for their land and strength and confidence to go out and do whatever is needed in order to defend this homeland. And so we're seeing two different populations, it seems like, the younger generation who are out on the front lines defending the country. And something that we focus a lot with in the fellowship is, of course, the elderly. And something that touches me so deeply is when I go to visit the elderly who are affected by this war, that before the war, I would go and visit the elderly and they would talk about their stories from the past of being Holocaust survivors and how they made Aliyah, where they came from, what their family endured before they had this homeland. And when I go now, it's a sort of hope for the future with such a deep sadness and brokenness of what's happening in this generation, in our country, in Israel. I remember visiting with a Holocaust survivor in Sderot who watched her best friend across the street get murdered by Hamas terrorists. The terrorists were right outside of her building. She remembers the green, all the different gear that they were wearing with Hamas in her backyard, carrying big guns. She was sure it was her end. And she ended up surviving. And even when all the people from Sderot evacuated because it wasn't safe, she said, "I'd rather die in my home than live once again as a refugee." And she went on to tell me the story of her miracles that she saw during her life and her family's life during the Holocaust. And the fellowship was there to bring her food every single week until the people went back to Sderot and life started operating again. But it stuck with me, that idea of how it's so connected, what's happening now to the Jewish people, specifically for the elderly, of what they endured. And for you, Rabbi, your mother's a Holocaust survivor, correct?
That's right. One of her refrains is that she never thought that she would live to see this kind of level of anti-Semitism again in her life. Now, she was only six when she was put on a train. She was born in Vienna together with her siblings. She was the youngest of four. They were all put on a train by her parents. Her father was a rabbi in Vienna. And there was a program called the Kindertransport, where about 10,000 children from Vienna and Germany, and later on in Hungary, were put on trains and sent to the United Kingdom, to England. Her parents did not survive. Her parents were murdered in Yugoslavia, and their bodies were found in a mass grave and were later transferred back to the Jewish Burial Society in Vienna. That's the tragedy. I believe that at least one of the victims of October 7th herself was a Holocaust survivor. To be a survivor of all of the horrors of the 1930s and 40s in Europe, to come to Israel, to live a full life, and then to be slaughtered by a new incarnation of this evil is just a horrific tragedy.
Well, Rabbi, you were raised on those stories as the child, first generation of Holocaust survivor, who had a story that was, I mean, just to hear it could make you cry. And you lived that and you were raised on that. Your mother wrote about her story, both of heroism and miracles and also heartbreak. How has that shaped you in who you have become and how you look at the world now in a post-October 7th reality?
Well, I think it's important to note that my mother never wanted to call herself a survivor because she had not been in Auschwitz. She was not in the concentration camps. She felt that she was one of the lucky ones, even though she was raised as an orphan, because she got to grow up in England. But at the same time, I think she also realized that she needed to leave a legacy for her children. And there was somewhere in my subconscious as I was growing up that I think made me make the choices that I did make as far as what career I wanted to go into. I had originally planned not to have anything to do with the rabbinate, or, you know, I had no desire to be a rabbi. But I guess knowing that my grandfather, his life was cut short at such a young age, it was a young father, never having the opportunity to fulfill his career aspirations may have influenced me in some way. But my parents were an interesting combination. You know, the fellowship is so helpful to so many of the elderly Jewish community in the former Soviet Union and now in some of the underprivileged communities in Israel. But it's also important to know that so many Holocaust survivors were able to pick up the pieces from their shattered lives and really rebuild and find success in their lives. And again, my mother would say that she's one of the lucky ones. She met my father when she came to the United States. He was the child of immigrants, but they came a generation before from Russia. And my father was in the entertainment business, and he became an entertainment lawyer, which brought my parents to Los Angeles, to Hollywood, California. And my father was in the music business, helping to produce and represent recording artists. So I have sort of a dual persona.
Why you're a cool rabbi.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I used to be cool, but the music that I listen to today isn't as cool as it used to be. But anyway.
So I want to end with two last questions. The first question is, where do you see the needs of the fellowship moving forward? And the second question is, you have endured not easy times. Just being a rabbi during these times takes so much wisdom and strength and decisions, supporting others. Is there a go-to Bible verse that you turn to get strength?
First of all, I defer to your wisdom and to your oversight, because you have such a global perspective on what's going on in the world, in the Jewish world right now, much larger than my own. I'm looking at my own local community, and I see various needs. Unfortunately, in just a matter within a decade, most of our Holocaust survivors will no longer be here. But there are still many, many members of the Jewish community who, because of different circumstances in their lives, are going to need the support and the help of the fellowship. And certainly with so many immigrants coming to Israel, that's going to be a vital area of support where our Christian brothers and sisters can be of support. You know, just this last Saturday on our Sabbath, we read a verse that was recited by the prophet Balaam in the book of Numbers. And he said, "Hein am levadad yishkon," which in English means, "Behold, this nation is a solitary nation. They're separate from everybody else. They're not counted among the other nations of the world." And I think that in a certain way, that has never been truer since October 7th, when we see that even the United Nations, which is supposed to represent the family of man, has essentially ignored the Jews, has never once condemned Hamas, has never once acknowledged that the horrors that took place, especially against women and children on October 7th. We truly are a completely separate nation. Sometimes that's how it feels. But what I tell people, especially because of my association with the fellowship, is that we're alone, but we're not lonely, because we do have so many friends who wish to attach themselves and connect with the Jewish people and be a part of that blessing that was given to Abraham, our father. And so that's what I'm so grateful for. The verse that I guess the other verse that I would say is a go-to verse is from Psalms 27, which says, "Kaveil Hashem," place your hope in God. And then King David goes on and he says, "Chazak v'yameitz libecha," be strong and be of good courage in your heart. And then once again, even when the chips are down, even when you placed your hope in God and things didn't work out as you planned, be strong, be of good courage, and continue placing your hope in God, because you may not see the dawn right away, but the dawn is coming. The sunrise will once again come for the Jewish people. The people of Israel are strong, we are resilient, we are patient, and we know that there is a beautiful and glorious history waiting for us in the future.
Well, Rabbi Kropkin, thank you for not only inspiring me, as you always do, but inspiring all of our listeners. We are going to continue to keep your community in our thoughts and prayers for safety. And I look forward to seeing you soon here in Israel.
Thank you for everything you're doing, Yael. And it would be such a joy to be able to see you once again in person, hopefully at the end of the summer. Looking forward.
Thank you for your time. Toda.
Thank you. Blessings to all of your listeners. Thank you. Okay.